Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubinstein. I'm a travel and entertainment journalist. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. On today's episode, I'm joined by the chef, broadcaster, food writer and campaigner, Hugh Fearnley-Whittingstall. We first got to know Hugh through his much-loved River Cottage TV series and books, filmed at his River Cottage estate on the Devon-Dorset border. His uncompromising commitment to seasonal, ethically produced food and his concern for the environment inspired a vast and loyal fan base. Alongside more than 20 cookery shows, he's also tackled powerful issues in his documentary campaigns like obesity, the illegal wildlife trade, fishing, and the war on plastic. He's the author of numerous best-selling cookbooks, and he's back with a new one, Eat Better Forever. We talk about that, his life-changing trip to Africa, which shaped his food philosophy, what it was like traveling around India for 4 months with his young family, how a close shave while filming nearly left him in a Vietnamese jail, the power of wild swimming throughout the freezing winter months, and his favourite staycation spots. All that and more coming up on the Travel Diaries. Hugh Fearnley-Whittingstall, welcome to the Travel Diaries. Thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
Great. Well, at a time when no one is able to travel anywhere, I'm so pleased that today we're going to be going on a journey through your life's travel diaries so far, some armchair traveling for us all. And we're going to start with chapter one, your earliest childhood travel memory. What would that be?
It's interesting, isn't it, thinking about travel at a time like this. And just in just preparing to talk to you today, it's everything's felt like a fantasy. You know, I long to go to any and all of the places that we're going to talk about today. But the first of them for me, the most intense childhood memory of travel that I have is Greece.
Uh-huh.
And a holiday in Greece when I can't have been more than 5 or 6. We went there because my dad had made great friends with a Greek gentleman when they were at university together, and they became great friends. He was called Spiro, and Spiro married an English woman who was actually a friend of my mother's. So it was all very neat and tidy, and they lived in Athens, and they had a little holiday house on an island called Aegina. And we went there a few times, and I think maybe one or two summers in a row. And I'm sure my memories have fused from different trips there. But I have intense memories of sound and smell and taste from visits to Aegina. And I can sort of conjure them. There was a lot of sitting out in the garden in the evening, and the sound of the cicadas and grown-ups chatting and drinking and laughing, and me and my sister being allowed to stay up a little bit late and be with them. And I can remember grabbing pistachio nuts from a bowl on the table, and lemons and limes, maybe other citruses too, growing in the garden. And I remember the smell of a cut lime and the incredible zesty citrus aroma of the lime skin that was probably being cut for their gin and tonics. Although I also remember them drinking ouzo, that extraordinary licorice drink. Which I have sampled since, and it's not a drink that travels well, but if you are in Greece and the sun is shining and maybe there's a little bit of burnt octopus in front of you, and indeed these pistachio nuts, which I keep coming back to, I think I probably didn't taste them for another 10 or even 20 years because you just couldn't get them in the UK at that time. So they were something extraordinarily exotic. And I remember peeling them, picking the shells off for my mum and maybe others to eat, and then snaffling the odd one myself and this bright green nut with an extraordinary distinctive taste. Oh. I've always enjoyed pistachios ever since. In fact, if I do end up with a bowl in front of me, I have to just apply a little bit of self-control not to binge the entire bowl.
Me too. How interesting that the earliest travel memory that you have really focuses on food, on smell and taste, as you say. So did that love of food and cooking come at a very young age for you?
It did come. Yeah, I got involved in cooking at home at a very young age, helping my mum in the kitchen. I remember mincing. We used to have, if ever we had a leg of lamb for a Sunday lunch, then a day or two later it would be shepherd's pie, which was one of my favourites. And we had a crank-handled mincer. And my mum would feed the bits of the leftover lamb along with a few slices of onion through the mincer, and I would turn the handle, or sometimes we'd swap jobs, although she'd get very anxious that I was going to mince my little fingers. So the sounds and smells of the kitchen are always very prevalent in my memories wherever I am in the world.
Yeah, flavours and places are so intrinsically linked. It's not just the chefs on this podcast that talk about that. And Greece, well, I mean, such vivid flavours. So a great answer first up. Right, let's keep going. Chapter 2 is the first place that you fell in love with. Where would that be?
Well, beaches have always been a big thing in my life and on family holidays. That first travel memory that ran so deep was Greece. But actually, when I was growing up, we mostly had domestic summer holidays in the UK. And that's how I discovered Dorset, which I love and where I lived for a long time. Mm-hmm. And basically the West Country, because we had holidays in Dorset and Devon and Cornwall. But we settled into Cornwall from, I guess, when I was about 10 years old. And we went back to the same holiday cottage near a little village called Port Quinn. And just up the cliff path, probably a good half-mile walk from a lovely beach called Ephaven Cove. And this is probably still my favourite beach in the world, even though I haven't been there for quite a few years now. We went to Cornwall pretty much every year for nearly 10 years from between the age of about 10 and 20 when I started sort of making my own decisions about where to go on holiday. But we had pretty much a decade of family holidays in North Cornwall, mostly in this little cottage on the cliffs above Ephaven. And we walked down there pretty much every day, often several times a day. Mm-hmm. And it's a reasonably well-known beach, but it's just round the corner from a much bigger and better-known beach called Lundy Bay. Mm-hmm. But Ephaven Cove was almost further away from any car park, and people who went to Lundy often didn't know that if you just walked another couple of hundred meters over the cliff, you would find this miniature version, this little tiny cove flanked by high rocks and rock pools and with a big sandy chunk at low tide. But it was different things at different states of the tide, and at low tide you had the sand. And it went far enough out that you could surf on the incoming waves, and it was flanked by these rocks and amazing rock pools where I would scrabble around for crabs and prawns. And I also fished off the rocks there. Didn't catch very much, but put in a lot of time casting spinners, caught the odd mackerel, dreamed of catching a bass, which I never did till many years later. I can picture this beach so well. And another feature it had that became perhaps a little more interesting and exciting when I was a teenager, it had a sort of grassy bowl in the cliff top that was quite near the cliff edge, but somehow very safe. So you could sit in this grassy bowl, or in the evenings or even at night, you could lie down and look up at the stars. And I went there with friends who are still my friends, teenagers, people I knew growing up who are still in my life. And we would lie there and look at the stars and talk, and maybe pass around a somewhat illicit half bottle of cheap whiskey that we'd got from the local off license, which made the conversation flow a bit more. And I've been back there a few times, every few years. And I've taken my wife there and shown her. And when I just find that little bowl again, it'll never go away. I mean, I hope that piece of cliff remains intact, whatever strange things that the climate and the sea do. I mean, it's been there for millions of years. I hope it'll be there for millions more. But that's a very, very special place for me.
Oh, yeah. Cornwall's such a special place to so many people on the Travel Diaries. It really is an all-time favourite, a hidden gem, a first place people fall in love with. It means so much to so many people, especially us Brits, doesn't it?
It does. I have to say, I'd like to think we were sort of early adopters. We started going there in the 80s, but of course it was already a very popular destination, especially around Polzeath and Rock and places like that. I'd be a little anxious to go there midsummer these days.
Yeah.
And when I have snuck back in the last few years, it's usually been off season, which is also a wonderful place to go, a wonderful time to go. And I will go back again soon. I'm due a dose. And of course, I live in East Devon, so I'm really not very far away. It's not more than an hour and a half, 2 hour drive to Epphaven Cove from here. But still, it's such a... Sometimes you don't want to rush back to the places that hold such strong memories. You don't want to be there too regularly. You want to build up a yearning, I think, to go back to those places and then act on impulse sometime when you maybe wake up in one morning and think, you know what, today's the day. There's no reason why I couldn't go there today. And maybe that'll happen sometime in 2021. I mean, it's been such a strange time recently that I can see that going to look for that special place that holds such a place in my heart, this could be the year to make that happen again.
Oh, here's to hoping. I think we've all been drawing up mental lists of the places we want to rush to once we can leave the living room, haven't we? And beyond being in Cornwall, your answer I really love because it reminds me of such a crucial rule of travelling, which is to look around the corner of the touristy spots. It's where you find those gems like Epphaven Cove.
Yeah.
So from formative holidays to transformative travel experiences now, chapter 3 is the place where you learn the most about yourself.
This is probably a hard one and not a hard one. I mean, I think probably the most transformative travel experience I've had was going to Africa when I left university, a trip that I'd planned for some time. Now, as well as growing up and learning very quickly a love of food and cooking, the other obsession I had, and it really was an obsession, was wildlife. And I think that partly came from a kind of vital move that my mum and dad made at the very beginning of the 70s when they left London and moved to a rented farmhouse in Gloucestershire. And for me, that was at the age of 6, that was moving from an urban environment to this great, huge outdoor space that just seemed an amazing adventure. And it just changed my life. And I immediately became fascinated by birds and not just birds, but birds and snails and beetles. And I did all those things that, I mean, not very acceptable these days, but I collected birds' eggs and I kept snails in a box and fed them on grass and lettuce leaves and went on walks and bike rides with my friends and looked out for all sorts of strange. And these were times when the life in the hedge in the countryside was just brimming. Mm. And that enthusiasm extended out to excitement about the wildlife that I might one day get to see. And that was largely experienced through the medium of television. And of course, David Attenborough and the Life series and the, you know, and other wildlife documentaries. I just couldn't get enough of them and picture books as well. And I just had it in my mind that one day I would travel to Africa and I would see some of these animals for myself. And so in my last year at university, a friend and I started hatching a plan and we wanted to go to Africa, but we also wanted to be useful. So we made contact with a few NGOs and conservation organizations. And in the end, we got commissioned to to write a paper for a symposium that was due to happen the following year. And we decided to plan our journey based around the idea of looking at the relationship between conservation authorities and local people and the wildlife itself, this three-cornered thing that was often quite tense and fraught. Mm-hmm. And it was a fascinating journey, and it gave us access to some incredible places in Southern Africa. We started in South Africa, and in Johannesburg we bought a secondhand pickup truck, and we traveled to Swaziland and Botswana and Namibia and Zimbabwe. It took us 5 months, and we visited over 20 different game reserves.
Oh, how wonderful.
And while we were there, we interviewed people from the local population. We interviewed the people who ran the reserves, and we had endless tapes. In terms of my memory, with just the extraordinary things that we saw. We saw everything. We saw amazing, we had amazing experiences with lions, cheetahs, leopards, the big stuff. But it's also, we camped out in very wild places. We once heard an absolutely deafening roar in the middle of the night that woke us up with a great start. And we woke up in the morning to find that a family of lions, they'd moved on before we woke, but had slept within 50 meters of where we were in our tents.
Oh, wow.
So we had some really extraordinary experiences. And during that time, my ideas about getting involved in wildlife conservation began to consolidate. And we started planning an idea that would bring us back. Our time ran out and our money ran out, and we went back to the UK and we wrote our paper for the symposium. But I started to plan another venture, which was to write a book about the experience. But I felt I needed to go back there and do some more interviews and meet some more people. And that book never actually happened, because I took a strange left turn. In order to keep the body and soul together, I needed to get a job. And I went to work in the River Cafe at Hammersmith. A friend of mine was working there as a waitress, and she managed to get me a job in the kitchen. And when I started at the River Cafe, the plan to go back to Africa and finish this book and maybe get more deeply involved in wildlife conservation was a very, very live plan. But I got very drawn into the world of cooking. I had an amazing time at the River Cafe. And in the end, I parked the big wildlife conservation plan and took this left turn into professional cooking and then food journalism and writing about food. And a few years later, was making TV shows about cooking.
Such an incredible journey. I mean, how it all unfolded.
Yeah, I mean, I have no regrets about the choice I made. In fact, it wasn't even really a choice. It was a sort of evolving, you know, one thing happened and then another thing happened, as it so often is in life. And then I was doing something different. But I think the experience, the reason this was such a transformative thing, even though the hopes I took with me to Africa and the ideas about what I would do with my life never quite materialized, at least not at that point, they changed me. And I think that they made me, even though I went into food and cooking, they informed the kind of food and cooking, not in terms of the food on the plate, but the underlying thing, that I was always really interested in where ingredients came from and what the effect of our choices is. I saw the connection from early on between food and agriculture and the choices we make and the wider world, and the connection between food and the environment. And so when I was able to, many, many years later, even after making the River Cottage series, start looking at the big picture, and for example, the way we source our fish, and the series I made for Channel 4, Fish Fight, and the connection between conservation and the choices we make around food. I don't think I'd have been in that place if I hadn't had that experience in Africa all those years before.
So it really shaped your food philosophy. I assume that philosophy also fed into your new book, which is Eat Better Forever. I've really enjoyed tucking into some of the recipes and also a lot of the information that you provide around the key recipes in the book. So can you tell me a little bit more about it and the inspiration behind it?
There is a massive overlap, as it happens, between the foods that keep us well and the foods that if we choose them do tend to be the more sustainable choices that are better for the planet. And that this is the direction of travel in my cooking, and it's the philosophy that underpins our River Cottage Cooking School, and it's absolutely at the heart of this book. And it's that, you know, more and more our food choices should be plant-led. This is where the great food that keeps us well and the great diversity of foods that keeps food delicious is. Even though we get very excited often by meat and fish, and I am still an omnivore, the foods that I think should be front and central in our cooking are local, seasonal, plant-based foods. Mm-hmm. And I don't just mean what we call veg, fruit and veg, but also seeds and nuts and grains. And so the book has got these absolutely front and center. It's also underpinned by an idea that if we're trying to be healthy, we don't necessarily want to put all our eggs in one basket. It's kind of a reaction against the idea of the single fix or one big idea diet book that tells you that it's all about gut health, or it's all about low carbs or reducing sugar, or it's all about fasting. There are actually many elements to healthy eating, and it really doesn't do us any harm to get a handle on a bunch of them.
A more holistic approach.
Yeah, a more holistic approach. People like things to be organized and clear, so I've come up with 7 ways to transform your diet. That's the subtitle of the book. And the first one of them is what I call go whole. Just make whole natural foods the fundamental building blocks of your cooking and your eating. When we start relying too much on processed foods and in industrially made foods, we find that a lot of the good stuff has been taken out. The ingredients have been refined to make them sort of more malleable and manipulable. And then stuff we really don't need, or our body doesn't even frankly know what they are, various additives and preservatives and E-numbers have been put in, again, for sort of purposes of longer shelf life. And we end up with foods that are nutritionally less than what they should be and have a bunch of stuff in them that isn't really good for us. And this is at the heart of the food crisis and the health crisis, not just in the West, but all over the world, where we see growing levels of obesity and people being made very, very unwell because of fundamentally because of the way they're eating.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away.
My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
I think that would have to be India. India is a world of travel. I mean, India is so many, many different destinations. And it's very dominant for me because I've been there quite a bit recently, but I'd never even been to India at all until 2014. And we went as a family. I took 4 months out and we took a chunk of time, January to April 2014.
How amazing.
Yeah, it was wonderful. My wife had traveled to India before. I never had. I traveled to all sorts of amazing places in the world, but I'd never been to India. And I'd somehow, in the most ridiculous way, I kind of thought it was sort of too late. I was too old to discover India. You know, I hadn't been in my gap year and lots of my friends had and lots of people I knew had traveled there. And I somehow thought I'd sort of missed the Indian boat as if it wasn't possible to go to a completely new and exciting destination just after turning half a century, which is what it was, in fact. And it was an extraordinary trip and brilliant to be there with the whole family. The youngest kids came out of school and the elder ones came out for their school holidays. And we had the most brilliant time. I mean, what was one of the best things about the trip is that we didn't really, we arrived without an itinerary. We had some friends who were living in Delhi and we thought, well, we'll get to Delhi and we'll see where we go from there. And we used Delhi as a base and went on various forays around India based on recommendations from people we met pretty much after we got there. We had a few ideas about places we'd like to visit. But to travel without, without a pre-planned agenda was quite a new experience. And also to have this extraordinary country that's pretty much a continent sort of unfolding before you. I think we were nervous that as we were heading out there, that there was just too many possibilities, that we'd suffer from a sort of options paralysis, that, you know, we wouldn't be able to make our minds up about where to go.
Yeah.
But in the end, we just bumped into people who said, oh, you must go there. And if it seemed like that it was a vaguely practical opportunity, then we thought, yeah, we'll give it a whirl. And it was actually a lovely way to travel and to discover a new place.
Oh, that's great. I mean, brave, but fantastic. I have to ask, because this trip sounds so incredible and you were getting insider tips while you were out there. What was, you know, a recommendation that you got that was a real standout from a local or someone who has experience with India?
Gosh, well, so many different places. One of my favorite places was we went to a place called Bharatpur, stayed in which is a bird sanctuary and just an amazing wild place, and it's actually not far from the Taj Mahal, so we snuck that in while we were there. Okay. And that was amazing, but the highlight for me was these early morning walks in Bharatpur. And a couple of times I went with my son, Freddie. So he was 11 and just getting interested in birds and wildlife. And we got up at dawn a couple of times and met a local guide and went walking on these trails through Bharatpur and saw beautiful birds and deer and just heard sounds that we'd never heard before. And it's just something that will always stay with me, a very, very special time.
And how about a favorite hotel? Is there a place that really stuck out to you as a favorite place to stay?
We stayed in lots of different lovely places in India and having amazing memories, mostly only once, but there's one place we've been back to quite a few times, and it has a particular sort of role, really, which is that we only stay there on the way in and on the way out, but it's become really special. It's one of our favorite places, and it's in Mumbai, and it's called the West End Hotel, and it was recommended by a friend. So it's not one of the sort of glamorous or exotic destinations. It's the sort of way in and the way out, but it's somewhere that we've just got huge affection for. I've probably stayed there half a dozen times now, usually with family. And they're just incredibly friendly. It's got a lovely little restaurant. It's not a fancy place at all. And I mean, I would just recommend it for anyone who wants a really dependable, friendly, easygoing place right in the middle of Mumbai. It happens to be it's a sort of shortish walk to the Mumbai cricket ground, mm-hmm. where one evening we went to watch an amazing 2020 game. So, I mean, this is the extraordinary thing about India. It's so many different places and so much excitement on so many different levels. It's got incredible wild places, beautiful birds. I mentioned Bharatpur before. But the urban life I also find really, really exciting. And staying in Mumbai and enjoying the street food and then going to a cricket match is just part of the thrill.
Mm. And it's interesting that you mention your love of Mumbai as a city there, because I would say that your name is very much synonymous with the countryside. So, you know, are you a city lover as well?
I find that living in the countryside enables me to enjoy trips to the city so much.
Right.
And that includes London. You know, I did live in London for most of my 30s, and I spent quite a lot of time trying to escape, you know, going out at the weekends to see my mum and dad or stay with friends or find other ways to get out of the city. Since I moved full time to the West Country, which I did shortly after I discovered River Cottage, where I've lived with my family ever since, I've found trips to the city really good fun, to any city, to whether it's London or Paris or Bristol, or when we travel to further afield to some of the big cities of the world. Mm. And I've really enjoyed Delhi and really enjoyed Mumbai, as I have other Indian cities like Pune, where I spent some time. So that the buzz from being in the city makes sense to me because it's not my, you know, it's not my home patch. It's not my natural habitat.
And so that juxtaposition really helps you to appreciate it, right? So can we talk a little bit about River Cottage? For my international listeners who might not be familiar with it, can you explain a little bit about it? Such a bastion of the British countryside.
Well, River Cottage has evolved because originally it was the name of a little cottage where I lived for a while and then made some TV shows, which were essentially about the downsizing life. It did actually genuinely reflect my move out of the city in search of a different way of living and raising my own livestock and growing my own food. And we made that series in the original cottage for 3 years in a row. And then I set up a cookery school of sorts, a sort of events place in a farm nearby. And we continue to film as we transform that into a garden and a kitchen and an occasional pop-up place that local people could visit. And now River Cottage HQ, as we call it, is a small farm and cookery school in East Devon, not far from Lyme Regis, just over the border between Lyme Regis and Honiton. And it's where we run our cookery courses and still make occasional TV shows. We spent a lot of the first lockdown putting our favorite courses online. So we now have an online cookery diploma at River Cottage, but we're really looking forward to opening
That's
again
fantastic.
As soon as possible and welcoming people back. This is what we love to do, is teach and inspire people about growing their own food and cooking, spending a day with us or maybe doing one of our 4-day courses, and then heading home brimming with ideas and projects and possibilities and just sharing in that extraordinary excitement around food, especially food that you have been able to make close connections with, ideally by growing some of it yourself, or by maybe learning to make your own cheese, or even cure your own, smoke your own fish and meat, or just to find out what those connections are with local food growers and how satisfying it is if you're able to source at least some of the food from the local community. And, you know, in the end, I think, as with travel, one of the things that makes life make sense really is to create stories of our own. And this is what happens when we come back with memories, but of great trips we've had, or holidays, or adventures. Those memories are really the stories that have stayed with us. And great food always has a great story. And if you want your food to help you to feel good, not just in body, but also in soul, then it means a lot to know the story of where that food came from, to meet the person who grew the vegetables, or have a visit to somewhere where they're actually making cheese, or to connect with a farm and come home with something from that farm. Mm-hmm. Bring something of the provenance of the food into your kitchen and into your life, and make those connections, rather than what's often quite a sterile experience of just picking a vac-packed ingredient off a supermarket shelf.
Absolutely. And I saw that you've been connecting with your landscape there as well, because on your Instagram you were taking some wild sea swims right in the midst of winter.
And in fact, even closer to home, we're very lucky to have a pond. I've already had a swim this morning. In fact,
outside?
Yeah, in the pond. Last week I was breaking the ice. You can see pictures of me ice swimming on Instagram.
Wow.
The last couple of days the ice has melted, but the temperature today was 5 degrees.
Oh my goodness.
So it's actually, in fact, I started this conversation wrapped up in my woolies.
Because you just came in from the pond.
Yeah, I came in from the pond about 45 minutes before we started chatting. And the reason I've taken a couple of breaks is because I've got the heating on in my little shed. And as I'm warming up from my swim, it's always the really nice feeling of slowly warming up from the inside. And I've got my merino wool leggings on under my jeans. And there comes a point when I've started my day when I actually start to get too warm, and then I have to turn the heater down and open the windows, and I can start sort of acclimatizing again to the temperature as it is around me. But it's such a buzz, this cold water in the morning. If I don't make it to the pond, or if I've got to do something early, I get a cold shower in. So one way or another, I get a dose of cold water every day. It's just something that's become part of my routine for starting the day.
And do you really feel tangible kind of health benefits from it? Or what is it about it that you love?
I definitely think it's helped me. I think it's really good at dealing with stress. It's helped me sleep better. I mean, this is
really
me talking personally.
Yeah.
And it's just something now that's such a part of the fabric of my day that, you know, I can't imagine a day without that cold water buzz at the beginning of it. It grounds me at the beginning of the day. It wets me, it waters me at the beginning of the day.
Yeah, I've never tried it, but I want to give it a go, because like you say, I think it sounds mentally cleansing as well as kind of physically and spiritually.
It's very invigorating, there's no doubt about it. I would just say to anyone who's thinking of taking the plunge, don't just go and jump in a really cold pond or even the sea in the middle of winter. You get away with a dip in the sea because the water temperature doesn't get too low. But be ready with some, don't stay in too long, and be ready with some nice warm clothes to put on afterwards.
Brilliant. Well, chapter 5 then is your hidden gem, a place that maybe my listeners might not know that much about that means a lot to you.
Well, I've chosen somewhere that's a bit of a recent discovery, and it's actually quite local. It's not some far-flung exotic destination. It's a really lovely little hotel right in the middle of Totnes, which is less than an hour from here, and it's called The Bull. It's in Devon, on the south coast of Devon, not at all far from the sea. In Totnes, which, if you don't know much about it, is a very quirky and interesting Devon town that's got something of a reputation for having a kind of, how shall I put it? I mean, people are drawn to Totnes for a slightly alternative lifestyle, and which I think is great. There was a time when somebody, I think some wag who had visited, did a little bit of minor graffiti on the Totnes, on the Welcome to Totnes sign as you came in, and they wrote "Twinned with Narnia," which I always thought was a nice touch. But I have friends who live in and around Totnes, and indeed the people who run the Bull are friends of mine, and they've created this wonderful atmosphere, delicious food. They've got that sort of thing that I think that the buzz phrase would probably be, there's a lovely touch of wabi-sabi about it. Things that are old are still there. Some of the walls have been tidied up but not recovered, so you've got that patina of old cracking plaster work and lots of lovely found objects that are just quirky and interesting, and it's just got a brilliant feel about it.
Oh, that sounds great.
Even though it's not too far away, it's just near enough to for a little escape for me and my wife to nip away for a night or two and just enjoy a little bit of luxury, and then a nice wander around Totnes. They've got a great market there at the weekend, and very near Dartmoor, so we can take in a walk or even a wild swim in the River Dart on the way there or on the way home. So the Bull in Totnes, such a special place.
Brilliant. Oh, I think that staycation discoveries are going to be much needed at the moment. So, okay, that's added to the list. It sounds great.
We managed to sneak in a couple of visits in between the lockdowns. We've been there twice in the last few months when it wasn't locked down, and we'll be, I hope, top of the list when we get a chance to get out again.
Brilliant. Well, in contrast then, chapter 6 is your worst travel experience. Is there a place that you maybe remember for the wrong reasons?
Well, I remember one place for, the wrong reasons, for having to leave it very quickly and in really quite scary circumstances. And that is Vietnam, where we were doing some undercover filming about the illegal wildlife trade. And I had already been to meet a man who was prepared to sell me some rhino horn. And we were working with a wildlife, an investigative wildlife charity, who were doing some undercover work and were preparing for a trip to a village where they were working with local operatives who were going to do some secret filming, where they were expecting to find a cache of hidden ivory and possibly other wildlife products. And we'd taken quite a few precautions. We'd gone in separately. We made sure we weren't sort of seen with them. But something hadn't quite gone right, and they had other operatives keeping an eye on the outside of the hotel, who realized that something was up when some local police came in, and they could tell they were asking questions about the guests who were, in fact, this team. And so we had to make a swift exit because we were filming undercover. So I had to take all the rushes that we'd filmed, and we travelled separately. The idea was we were then going to meet up again in Hong Kong. And so I travelled to the airport, and I had to buy a ticket at the airport, which can sometimes, raise eyebrows a little bit. And I felt from the minute I arrived at the travel desk that I was slightly under suspicion. There was a lot of looking at my passport, and at some point I actually saw someone take a picture of my passport photo with their mobile phone and then looked like they were sending it to someone else. And I just thought that, they're onto us. They're onto me. Something's not right. And then eventually, and quite suddenly, they produced a ticket and handed it to me and waved me on my way. And I thought, well, maybe it's all right then. And I checked in my bag and then went through customs. And I was standing in the customs queue, and I got to the front of the queue, and suddenly I heard a noise like a kind of barked military order, and all the uniformed immigration officers who were at the various booths, they all stood up, and a small group of a dozen uniformed people walked in. And I thought, oh, right, that's it. So they've, for some reason, they've left it to now, and this is where I get arrested. And I just stood there looking around, waiting to see what was going to happen.
Oh, my goodness.
And in fact, all the uniformed immigration officers who had stood up walked out of their booths and were then, in a very formal way, replaced by the other dozen or so people who'd come in their uniforms, who then sat down. And after a short pause, I was waved forward.
So they were just changing shifts.
Just a shift changeover done in a rather formal and slightly militaristic way.
Oh, that's so funny.
My heart was absolutely pounding. And I was just thinking, well, what is it going to be like in a Vietnamese jail, convicted of effectively of spying? I'm going to have a really grim time. How am I going to tell my family? All this was flashing through my head.
So we're now on to the final chapter of your travel diaries, Hugh, and that is chapter 7, which is, what is the destination at the top of your travel bucket list?
Well, it's quite simple, really. I want to go and see my mum and dad.
Oh, where are they?
They're in Gloucestershire. They're in a village called Wootton-under-Edge. The great news is that they've both had their vaccinations. So, in theory, really, I should be able to go and see them. But that's not quite how it works at the moment. We are not supposed to be traveling away from home. And, we're going to play it by the rules, but hope that it won't be too long now. In terms of travel bucket list, anywhere, any kind of travel is a bucket list at the moment.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's one of the journeys I'm most looking forward to making. But all the other things I've mentioned during this lovely conversation, they're all back on my. I mean, I'd love to. I feel a strong yearning to go back to Epphaven Cove. I want to pop down to the Bull for dinner and a night away. And the idea of getting to India again sometime in the next year or two, I would love to do. But it's not going to happen tomorrow.
We can but dream. Thank you for taking us all around the world from our armchairs, Hugh. Those were your travel diaries. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Oh, such a pleasure to talk to Hugh Fernley Whittingstall. His new book, Eat Better Forever, is out now. If you're enjoying the podcast and want to hear future episodes as soon as they're released, remember to hit subscribe on your podcast app of choice. To find out who's joining me on next week's episode, come and follow me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. I'd love to hear from you. And if you can't wait until then, there's always the first 3 seasons to catch up on, from Michael Palin to Poppy Delevingne and Saranal Fiennes to Rick Stein. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll speak to you next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.